Welcome to The C Word, the Conservators podcast. Today we're talking about furniture conservation. I'm Chloe Rumsey, an objects conservator based in Manchester.
I'm Liz Aver, a paintings conservator based in Amsterdam.
Hello, and we have a special guest host with us today. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, thank you for having me. I'm Abby Tudor, a furniture conservator based in London.
Whoa, hello everyone.
Hello and welcome back, Chloe.
Thank you very much. First episode of season 17, and I am just returning from my maternity leave from the podcast of the last season, season 16. So it feels really nice to be back. And I'm just trying to scrape the various bits of my brain back together from what I've been doing for the last 6 months, which is not this at all. But welcome, Abby. It's lovely to speak to you. Thank you for joining us on this episode on furniture conservation. We like to do a sort of specialism episode every season or so. And this one we decided to do on furniture. So welcome. Would you like to introduce yourself and your background and how you got into this?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here and to talk about furniture because it's what I love. And any time I get to talk about it is great. So I currently do furniture conservation. That's what I studied. I specialised in a furniture and related objects course. My career started more in furniture design. So I sort of came through the design side, went into manufacturing, went into sort of mass production of furniture, and then had a little rethink and thought, actually, I like old furniture, I like to preserve things, and I actually want to make less new and keep more old. So I switched to conservation, which has been a really, really nice change for me. And yeah, I'm really happy I did it. So yeah, it's good to be here. Good to be in this new kind of group. It's a really welcoming group of people. So yeah, glad to have joined.
Where and when did you study? How long have you joined the clan?
Yeah, so probably quite fresh. So I graduated in 2023 from West Dean College, which is down in Chichester.
Lovely.
Yeah, it's an old world down there. They've got you've got the Living Museum next door as well, so you can walk around all the old buildings that have been kept, you know, 13th century cottages and Tudor farms and things, and you're just in your own little world. It's great.
I'm always interested when we have conservators on who come from other careers first. And especially with furniture, it sounds like you had quite a full career in manufacturing before conservation. What was it that inspired you to make the switch?
Lockdown, to be honest. It happened then. It was 2020. And
the catalyst of our generation.
Exactly. I hate to say it. I'm sometimes like, there was other things in me, but it was basically my job went from being a very hands-on job to being a desk-based work from home. And I was managing factories on the phone, and it just wasn't as fun for me anymore. So I started, my mum actually runs a repair cafe.
Oh, wonderful.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so I was always really interested in what she was getting up to and all this kind of, you know, repair cafe ethos that she got into, I think around the same sort of time, actually.
Okay.
And yeah, we just decided that these are things that you could do. And she sent me actually the course at West Dean. She's like, there is actually a career in this. You can actually go into this. And yeah, so thanks, Mum. I went.
We're always grateful to mothers.
Aren't we? Yeah, there you go, Chloe.
Yay! New mothers, we'll see too. What he says in 20 years.
And then before that, why did you get into furniture production?
I mean, furniture's it's just so useful. It's just, I think it's like a sort of unsung hero of the house, like a little bit like, you know, art's always decorative and it's always beautiful, but furniture can be too. And I really like, that's why I like design of furniture. And I'm studying, you know, big innovative architects like Mies van der Rohe, who did the Barcelona chair, that was just like, or the Eames chair, you know, the things that like change a generation and how we see interior spaces. And yeah, I just really wanted to be involved with that. that side of art, I guess. It's like creating things that you can use, you can sit on, and it's like super comfy, and that looks really cool.
You're actually dredging up a memory from like the recesses of my mind. My local museum growing up, the Milwaukee Art Museum, I'm remembering on in like sort of the basement in the objects space where they had all the historical rooms, etc. Tucked away under the staircase, they always had a circle of chairs that were all designed, an assortment of different designed chairs.
Love it.
You
Love
were
it.
encouraged to sit on them and like actually,
Oh,
love that.
love a chair.
Yeah,
Oh,
love fixing a chair.
we're gonna get into that. Where are you now?
I'm working at the National Trust in Knowle. They got the studio down in Sevenoaks. There's two furniture. Nicola Treve is my like senior furniture conservator, and I jumped at the opportunity to work with her. She's fantastic. So I'm working in her furniture team.
Amazing.
It's great.
Wonderful.
So I came from I did a year in private practice after graduating as well, and I had always wanted to be fair, work for the National Trust or an institution like that. It kind of, as a child, you have that as a child, you form your memories around history and like your things you go and see and the houses you go to and all that type of stuff. And
Everyone has a first house.
everyone does.
Yeah, mine's Ickworth.
Is it? Oh, I've not been to Ickworth. That's really lovely. I've heard good things. Mine's this little one called Little Malvern Hall up in Manchester, which is just an old Tudor, like wiggly, wonky old house, which is just so interesting.
Say it
Maybe I
again.
should.
Have I been there? I might have been there.
Little Malvern Hall?
I think I've been there. Are there ducks nearby?
We used to feed
Yes,
Are
I
there ducks nearby?
That does not narrow it down, but you
There is. So it's lovely. It's kind of come full circle for me to be a part of the story for a lot of the pieces in the trust now is really great.
So shall we kick off with a definition? Because we've sort of veered towards some things with design and comfort and use and stuff. So what do we feel about the definition of furniture conservation? I suppose at the moment, what is furniture? To start with, what is furniture?
What is furniture? It's an interesting one because there, as I mentioned, the course I did was furniture and related objects. And it kind of keeps the door open to things like writing boxes or jewelry boxes or things that are made from wood in a furniture type construction but sit on furniture. And I think maybe furniture in its basic sense, things we use like chairs, tables, cabinets, wardrobes, they're functional items in a house. And then you can open it up into the things that are slightly more maybe ornate and more decorative as well. So yeah, no, I think I don't know. I don't know what the related objects really means. I looked at a rocking horse. Is a rocking horse a piece of furniture or is it
Oh,
a
that's a really good one.
Someone asked me this last night, actually, as well.
That's a really good one. Because I
What
was
is
sitting here
it?
thinking of, those ridiculous gold, becupeted side tables that you find, and there's, a piece of marble on top, and that's not functional. That's more of a sculpture than anything else, but it is a piece of furniture. And I suppose we get in, the particularly the more expensive or the posher of the furniture ends.
Materials start to change, get a
Yeah,
little
exactly. It's no
flashier.
longer where you put your keys. It's, it's a sculpture that you then put some flowers on, and then it's a, further sculpture.
I think it's really fun trying to imagine these ornate pieces of furniture in the homes that they, or palaces maybe that they came from. Be like, did they put their keys on them? What was there a cup of tea on it?
It was somebody's
It's a
cup of tea on it, at
surface,
least.
I mean, a lot of these things come through like quite heavily used, and it's quite hard to resist using a table, even if it is really ornate. If it is there, it's a surface to put things on.
Talking about the different furniture that you work with, is there any treatment as a furniture conservator that you think is unique to furniture conservation?
Yeah, no, that's a really great question. I will have to sit on that one for a bit. I don't know what's it, because really, I think the main standout material is obviously wood. So there's a lot of treatments that is specialized towards wood
Maybe
or
narrow it
treating.
down more. Like for example, I wouldn't have to, as a paintings conservator, I might have to work with a wooden stretcher, but in general, I'm not really fixing like joinery or something.
Yeah.
Did you have to learn a lot of different types of joinery from around the world?
Yeah, the pathway I think that's quite interesting with furniture conservation is it's sometimes you come through a maker's perspective and you sort of have to understand how things have gone together to be able to understand how things have fallen apart and therefore why the joints have failed. So yeah, you're dealing a lot with kind of construction techniques, as you say. Yeah, the ones from around the world are really interesting, and I wouldn't even begin to say that I know all of them or anything. But once you know sort of how someone might have designed something to go together, you can kind of try and unpick it and work out why the grain of wood is in one direction that way, and what kind of movement they're trying to prohibit or allow for. I think that's one thing that you need to keep in mind with wood is obviously the expansion and the contraction, and not to fix things too firmly in place, otherwise you cause cracks and things like that. So yeah, it's quite material specific in that way. Really interesting actually, a colleague of mine is working on a panel painting at the moment. And so she is combining, as a paintings conservative, combining the two, like you say, she tends would tend to work with wooden stretchers, but is now working with the wooden structure itself. It's like having a great time, I think, chiseling away at the back of a panel painting.
And that's one of my favorite things. I like my one of my favorite things to say is there's no such thing as specialisms. Obviously, I say that to paintings, a furniture, and as a textile conservator, so of course there are. But on my list, I've got the related disciplines. Obviously, holochrome painted is one of the big ones. Decorated surfaces in general is a discipline in itself, but so common with furniture. Upholstery as well. That's one of the, I'm sitting in a house surrounded by my grandparents' old furniture that is, it's not, it's old, it's, Edwardian, but it's not, unique or anything like that. So I'm looking at the chair that my cats have destroyed, and I know that I will need to reupholster it at some point because it's, falling apart. And as a textile conservator, I have, and a sewer, I can do quite a lot of the textile bits, but I don't know what I'm going to find when I open it up. I keep thinking, who's it that runs that the upholstery conservation course? I think somebody does. I can't remember the person's name. It's one of those
Is it the one in
intermittent.
Scotland? No.
I can't remember. It's one that's hosted by the Icon occasionally, and it comes onto the website and it's immediately sold out.
It Heather Porter?
It might be, actually. That rings a bell. If Heather Porter is listening to this, going, I have never done that
Yeah,
before in my life. I'm sorry.
not really. Sorry.
I don't remember. I have a terrible memory for names.
Just throwing out names.
Yeah. Though, Heather, if you were interested. yeah, so that I am aware of the materials involved, horsehair and textile and cotton straps and all of that sort of thing, but I don't know the first thing about it. But that
Yeah,
that's
that is really interesting. It's definitely a whole other realm of training and knowledge that you need. Like I've picked a lot of upholstery.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't even know how to reupholster a sofa or an armchair or anything like that.
No.
So yeah, I can take things apart.
From which we can learn quite a lot, though.
Definitely, definitely.
Yeah.
And you do, and you uncover a lot of old newspaper cuttings or
Yeah.
sort of things that have been stuffed inside just to keep it a little bit plumper.
Oh, that is one, like,
Great.
oh, it's side note of my parents moving house and sort of partially deconstructing my grandmother's sofa. Found two copies of the Radio Times from 1985 in there.
That is very cool.
Well, I'm curious because we're talking about treatments, but you mentioned that you spent your first year after schooling working privately. What does the private landscape look like as a furniture conservator?
The bread and butter is chairs because they obviously are the most used. And you get your probably always have a stream of Windsor chairs coming in or kitchen chairs and things like that. Yeah, then you could go to estates that still have their private collections and they'll have, you know, big names of furniture like Ince and Mayhew, and you've got beautiful Dutch marquetry cabinets coming in, or you know, William and Mary, and it's a wide variety. And there's also, I think the private sector opens up a difference in materials as well. So you might be a furniture conservator, but you might be asked to do a glass table, or you might be asked to do, I don't know, some more objects that might fall into what we might categorize as object conservation, terracotta or something like that, or jugs. I think the key thing with the private sector is like having that diversity, like being able to use your skills to problem solve in other areas to keep that that customer base really open. So I had a lot of fun there because as like those two things I mentioned, I had to learn how to do glass conservation to fix that glass table, which was a lot of fun, and I would happily do that more often. I think taping together loads of little pieces of glass is like doing a giant jigsaw. So the dealer world is really interesting as well because there's a lot of short deadlines. There's a, when the sales come up, so you don't have as much time to do the research and the documentation and necessarily like the testing that you would in institutions. And that is both fun and also frustrating at the same time. So you're sort of, you feel sometimes that you're limiting yourself to what you are most comfortable with using material wise or technique wise or whatever that is to get the job done in the timeline that you have. Rather than being like, what does this piece really need? And that's an interesting kind of struggle, I think, that you get in private. Maybe you guys have this, have a similar.
I would say the same. I think that's a common frustration.
Yeah, you know it works and you know it's reliable, so you're going to use it because researching what else and the optimum uses of something else is going to take you twice as long. Yeah.
I know customers going to pay twice as long. Yeah. I
Yeah,
think
this
actually
is
just
20% better than the other thing, but it has cost you £500 more.
exactly. I don't know what how your experience has been in sort of the private sector with clients, but one thing I do find quite interesting with furniture is the sort of perceived value of it. It's quite difficult sometimes to get. It takes a long time to fix a chair sometimes, for example. But some of these chairs are just everyday chairs, and people aren't going to spend thousands of pounds to fix it because it's only worth 20 quid. And brown furniture on the market is worth £50. And so you're thinking, like, where you've got to have a real sort of emotional attachment to something to invest that money to get your grandfather's chest conserved or restored or, yeah.
A lot of the textiles that I deal with at work that are from sort of freelance clients are they are quite domestic or sort of odd. So there's very rarely any significant financial value in them. think we've only once, off the top of my head, dealt with someone considering the value of it. More often, we get things that, somebody's bought at an auction and then thought, oh, I can't hang this. The top has come off, the person saying, well, I only paid 20 quid for this, so I will spend 3,000 pounds conserving it. But again, my stuff is always really big as well, so the cost just tots up. From what you've said, I have two questions now. And they're very different, and I'm sorry about that. I'm thinking about authenticity and originality. If you're doing quite a lot of heavy conservation or heavy restoration, replacing parts of it, are there often conversations about when does the Eames chair stop being an Eames chair and start being a chair from wherever it is you've bought the materials from?
Oh, that has like a whole sort of topic on it in itself,
Sorry.
isn't it, really?
That's
Because
some sort of Theseus philosophy, huh?
Let's do a quick PhD on when how much you can replace. But it's a similar thing with buildings. I think it's really fascinating looking at building conservation where you're having to replace stones. And then, we just went to York Minster, and you look at the whole facade has been recarved over time, and the stones replaced. And my friend asked exactly that question, like, when does that stop being a historic building and now is a new building? And yeah, so I think that with parts of furniture, you've got to make a new leg. Like, is that now half their furniture and half your furniture? I think sometimes we get really embedded in sort of the originality of material versus the originality of like maybe the design. And I think if you're true to the design and true to the sort of techniques, then the key, and if the value on the piece is its functionality, then you need to keep that replacement going to be able to enjoy it still. But it doesn't make it any less of an Eames chair, or I think that's my opinion. I think these things are designed to be used, and if it's going to fall apart and you're not able to use it, but you're like, no, but it's the original piece, then that's also a choice you can make. So yeah, it depends what value you put on it, I guess.
Can the same be said for, say, Elvis's footstool or something? If most of the bits have been changed, do you think in terms of
Yeah, I think that was actually, yeah, something I thought we could talk about is when you it could be an everyday, as you say, Elvis's footstool, an everyday stool that isn't particularly important in its on its own, or like Winston Churchill's desk, for example. And
That's a much more sensible example.
and the surface of that desk is really important because it's got all the marks from where he worked on it, and that's what's important to it. So you wouldn't replace it, and you wouldn't repolish it, for example. So yeah, I think that's the whole question on what makes the piece valuable to us, and what's the historical thing we're trying to conserve about it.
In your work, have you come across any fun additions by original owners or from the history?
I haven't personally. No, but you do get sort of quirky constructions. I mean, a piece I'm working on at the moment has got a type of dovetail joint that I've never seen before. And you're just a bit like, you open up the lid and you see inside, you're like, oh, I wouldn't have expected that. And then you're sort of going into the mind of whoever did it, and maybe it's a later alteration, and you're like, I could see why you sort of chopped that up, and oh, that's interesting. And yeah, it's quite nice to see.
I always enjoy with paintings when I see ingenuity used by artists. I often find sometimes an artist will use a different canvas base, like a towel or like a kitchen towel.
Ooh, that's
Yes,
so interesting. What
exactly.
does painting on a towel look like?
I actually do have one right here. This is a painting that was done. See the back there? Oh,
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, using I think that this was like for making a tea towel or making a mattress, some just
I
fabric.
love it.
That's so cool.
I love that. So for the listeners, Liz brought down a canvas, a painting to us to show us the back of it with lines, clearly a sort of functional piece of textile. Didn't show us the front.
I was
That's the
waiting for
most
the reveal.
conservative thing. The most conservative thing I've ever seen. Look at the back of this. It's so cool. Look at all the things you can see. Absolutely nothing to do with the
I'll pop it up on our Instagram.
I think the fun thing, just on that sort of topic of finding ingenuity, slight segue, but with furniture, I do love trying to find a hidden drawer or a hidden compartment. That is
Ooh. I thought that sort of thing
a
was only
lot
on
of
Antiques
fun.
Roadshow. Is that a real
No,
thing?
it's a real thing. Yeah, you kind of sort of prod around and you test a few false knobs and you're like, oh, is that a real opening? Or you often find them sometimes in the back of drawers. If you pull the drawer all the way out on the side of the back, is there then a compartment that slides out sideways? Things like that. And
What?
it's just ingenious.
Oh my
But
God. Do
yeah,
you
and then you
ever?
always think, is there going to be something in there, like a letter or a will?
Oh, the hidden
Yeah.
will of so and
Yes.
so.
The last owner of this bureau. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Hidden compartments is definitely, and the things you find inside some of them as well. You do, I mean, obviously a lot of it's probably just like old coins or dust. But sometimes I had a really lovely story actually with a piece that was again in that area of like, is it furniture, is it not? It was like a sewing box. And
Way up my
inside
street.
it, yeah,
Way up my street.
exactly. Yeah, you would have loved the little pin cushions in
Oh my
there.
God.
It was a dealer who had bought it, and I didn't realize this, but after I'd finished the treatment, he what's the word? He basically reunited the box with the items that he'd found inside it, and it was a beautiful letter of a lock of hair of a mother's a son who was 10 years old. It seems to be the history that he had done a lot of research into the family tree and found that this boy had possibly died young. And the letter was from her brother, and this box was a gift from her brother to her, and it was just really beautiful just to see that he had found that still in one of the compartments within the box. So
Oh,
yeah,
that's
you can get
lovely.
some lovely stories. There's a lot of stories, I think, behind these sort of used objects.
I wonder if we do that now domestically, whether we, whether it's all just shoeboxes full of birthday cards or whether we do, create little, accidental time capsules of memories and significances. I wonder if we do that.
Yeah, my mum's a big sort of questioner on that subject. If we're not writing letters as much anymore, what sort of trails are we going to leave behind us? No one's going to go through our emails.
Our Instagram posts. Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know. Jenny writes letters all the time, and I keep every
No.
single one in a shoebox, though, rather than
There
a
you
beautiful
go.
piece of furniture. Oh, I should sort that out, really, shouldn't
Yeah, you get a
I?
secret compartment in the back of a chest of drawers.
Perfect. Yeah,
A nice
yeah.
wooden chest. Yeah.
Yeah, ideal.
Oh, yeah, an oak coffer.
Oh,
Love an oak coffer.
oh.
It fascinating, actually, like Tudor era boxes where they like the lock boxes and that really carved from one piece of wood and made to keep all your valuables in. And yeah, I'd love one of those as a coffee table.
That's an interesting thing about the sort of mass production of as you called it, brown furniture, that there's so much stuff and there's so many, in general, things in the world that have historic sort of origins, at least. You can't keep them all. There's,
No. No, exactly.
and if we don't use things as they were originally used, got to find a different use for them.
Definitely. Yeah.
In terms of use, I was just reading actually about the British and the Dutch East India Trading Companies, and how with the ships that were bringing goods, there's often instances of the ships coming from the Netherlands arriving in the UK, and the ballast of the ship was tiles, and they would use the tiles to then construct in the locations where they went. But also sometimes in Britain, you can find in like bars that there are pieces of wood that have been used to make the ceiling that are actually from deconstructing the ships. Like when the ships reached the end of their life, they would take
Cool.
them apart and they
That's
would use
very
it to
cool.
construct.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. I would love it if someone did a study of that and do like a sort of a heat map of the UK of where these instances were, because it would be like Portsmouth and then radiating out, and London and radiating out, and it would be just mwah. It would be great.
That's like
Yeah.
a history tour in the making.
Exactly.
Tours of the old wooden compartments of boats.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. As an objects conservator, because I'm textiles, but origin and objects conservation, obviously you find loads of different things. My only real foray into furniture related conservation is fixing the screw holes of a chest. Because it was going on loan. It was Railway Workers Union Treasury chest,
Was how do you do
I
that?
think. Well, I loved this, and this is the it, I'm saying this because I really liked how it sort of changed how I felt about material use, I suppose.
Interesting.
So I asked on Twitter, as it was, help any furniture conservators. I have this to do, because essentially it was a huge heavy wooden chest lid. The hinges were sort of floating about on there because the whole screw hole had been eaten up. I tried various different things, but it was going on loan, so it needed to be sturdy, etc., etc. We know the drill. The drill, pun not
Ayo,
intended.
great pun.
And what I was advised to do by a furniture conservator was use animal glue and an appropriate wooden dowel, whittle the dowel to match the shape of the screw hole, and then adhere it in place with the animal glue, and then re-drill into that. Loved it. Loved everything about that. Fantastic. And then it sort of, I found that it kind of changed how I felt about the use of different materials, and what can you use the wood shavings for? You can use the wood shavings for filling holes in wood if you need to fill holes in wood.
Yeah,
And I just
sawdust.
saw it exactly. And so yeah, that's only a tiny bit of furniture conservation experience. I'm going to say that again because the table creaked. In fact, I'm just going to allow the table to creak. To There you go. Very old table. I'm sitting at my
It's so
grandparents'
apt.
table. So apt. Currently weaning on it. And I feel guilty every dinner time because my small child just smears like potatoes into it. I need to get tablecloth.
No, don't use it.
Yeah,
Let
we
the
just
wood soak it up.
have a sort of semicircle of grime and grease. Yeah, I just absolutely loved that treatment. It was very short treatment. I think there might have been only six screw holes that was required for. It was very, very effective, and it just it it's I found it a very sort of formative experience, if you see what I mean.
Also some old school conservation, and by that I mean something that people would have done, 200 years ago on their own project.
Plug and redrill.
Yeah, loved it.
I think it's really interesting you said, Liz, that's the old school sort of technique, and I think there's quite a lot of that type of like generation, like passed down generational techniques in maybe in furniture restoration workshops and furniture conservation has drawn on those that knowledge and the recipes and the old varnishes and the old glues and all that type of stuff, and it has that kind of old school type feel about it a lot of times, which I quite enjoy. You're working with people who just know their material and their glues. It's a lot of wood and a lot of animal glue, and it's yeah, it's a lovely group to be a part of, I think. There's a
No.
really interesting bit of work going on at the moment, I think, where I think the Getty are looking into interviewing a lot of people who are either retired or near retirement in the furniture restoration workshop world across like Germany, France, Britain, and gathering that knowledge and trying to keep it for longevity. And I think people are quite secretive sometimes about their hidden recipes and their different ways of making glue. And it's nice to think that that's probably going to evolve into more of a sharing culture.
But I love how quickly you can really scoot back in time when you start talking to people about when they learned things. And my experience of this is nothing to do with conservation. I was just knitting on a train once, and a very old woman was sat in front of me and started talking to me about knitting. And when she was talking about a specific way of knitting that she had learned when she was seven from a woman in her 90s or something. And instantly you're going back 100 years more than, and it's really, I just really like the word of mouth, and when people are training practical skills from older people. And as you say, Liz, the old school way of doing things, it transfers and it transfers and it transfers. It's the same skill, but it might be 400 years old by the time it gets to be recorded now.
That's a really nice way of thinking about
Love
it. A
it.
400-year-old skill, yeah.
Talking about this has me looking at painting conservation a little differently as well, because of course you have examples of people that have gone and restored a painting, but I feel like with furniture and textiles, those are things that historically people were interacting with on a daily basis. And so the kinds of treatments that get passed down are quite functional and effective. Whereas historically with paintings, you get a lot of examples of people who don't know what they're doing, just weren't going for it.
The amateur artist, yeah.
It's a lot of fixing old mistakes.
I love that though. When it comes to furniture use, that was one of the other things I was thinking about when we were talking about the sort of people's personal chairs and stuff. How do we work out simply weight bearing capacity? Like, is there a point at which you can say, this has been fully restored, I've used all of the tools in my kit, as it were, and don't sit on it
Included.
if you are, a large man or whatever it is. Like,
That's such an interesting
is there a
question.
way of telling? And just do people tend to talk about the it might have a full and active use as an object from conservation, but is it limited in any way?
That's really interesting. We actually had a very similar conversation not too long ago, about a basically a project where chairs were being surveyed for use, which is really exciting to be a part of because a lot of historical pieces are just like, just look at, don't touch. And you just want me to say, like, this is a chair, and this project is about allowing people to come in and experience what it's like to sit in this room, on the chairs that are in there, which is really lovely. But yeah, one of the questions was, well, this is a child's chair. How do we stop children over a certain age also, and can you say to people, you have a certain height or a certain weight limit? Is that a ethical thing to be putting out there, or how do you put that in a way that isn't divisive or restrictive on who can enjoy this experience and things like that? And it, you make when you ask if there's a way, you made me think about so in manufacturing there is a quite a destructive test method of checking a chair's design's limit. So when we use a sort of sample test new designs, they would go through really rigorous testing in terms of drop tests so that they don't break when you drop them, and also weight tests so you drop literally 50 kilos on it from a certain height and a certain number of times. And it might be that you record, it has to it, basically there's British standards, it has to pass a certain thing. And it's not something that you would do on a historical
No.
piece because you're not trying to test the design. So yeah, it's a really interesting point. I don't know if there is a way that you can say, definitely fix. I fixed a chair once for my family. It was my grandmother's chair, and it was a sort of Victorian folding picnic chair. And I used certain adhesives that were stronger for the part that was snapped, but still couldn't say because it snapped because a man sat on it, and I don't think maybe it was a children's chair. I don't really know. So you said, that's what it said. We can have it. It's now working again, but maybe let's just let my niece sit on it for now. Something like that. So it's quite hard to say really with any assuredness. But yeah, that's a really interesting point. How do you present things with certain limitations? I don't
That's
know.
so interesting, particularly when it's, furniture is for bodies to be on, and bodies come in a huge variety of shapes and sizes.
You can't say any certain things. It made me think about the roller coaster rides where you have to be a certain height to get in. So, like, can you be under a certain height to sit on
Exactly. Yeah, you could maybe you have to walk across a small bridge
the
and you can't get
If
over
it breaks, you're done.
the
Bye.
Small bridge made of balsa wood.
I am forever again more grandparents' furniture. I'm always saying to my partner, please don't stand on the Victorian nursing chairs to get to the window. Please. Still does it. They're not broken though, so
Holding
there you go.
up.
Maybe they're repros.
Strong wood. Oh, I
It's
actually have a
strong.
question in terms of materials that you conserve with, and wood strength. Because if you're working on a piece of furniture that's quite old and is used, was made with very strong wood, because I know that the longer a tree is alive, the stronger it is. And now we don't have as many old growth forests or old trees. Is there at all a supply issue in wood furniture conservation? Supply
I think
chain?
that brings up a
That's the
really another really
question.
interesting question around where you get your wood from, because a lot of workshops, so traditional workshops, will have break furniture, which is pieces that are just irreparable. That they've been completely destroyed. They might have been partially demolished, and you end up with a leg, and it's old mahogany, and it's of good stock, as it were. But there is a new sort of emerging conversation around the ethics of using exotic wood and the trade of exotic wood from that era and things like that. And I think that's evolving currently. I'm not sure which way it's going,
Wait, I have to
but
clarify. There's an ethical question about using the old wood from
yes.
pieces that are no longer together because of their personal histories of being part of colonialism.
Because of the wood trade, yes.
Okay, gotcha.
And you're right, and you don't get the same quality of mahogany these days. So you think, well, are you wanting to replace like for like? Are you just accepting the materials today are slightly different, and we kind of can do the best we can? No, that's a very open question. I think it is an evolving conversation that, yeah, it's it. It's interesting to see which direction it's gonna take. Because there's a lot of it's also then the question of, what do you do? There's a lot of wood out there from these pieces that are no longer usable, and a lot of stacks of oak that have been, drying for years or generations. And you think, obviously that's like exciting. That's fine. It's not an exotic
It's
wood. It's
such a
a British
waste then
timber.
to not use that material.
Exactly. Is it wasteful?
That really,
Yeah,
I mean,
and
the
there's nothing. Yeah, it's really nice being able to use something that is, I don't know, 300 years old or whatever, and you can repurpose it.
And should we be using more, as you said at the start of the episode, more old and less new in general?
Yeah.
I don't think I'll include this in the episode, but I wanted it makes sense to say because we have a furniture conservator right here. I give tours of the Van Gogh Museum,
Oh,
and
really?
have a painting that I always talk about that is a pa it's a painting of a chair, and the title of the piece is Gauguin's Chair. And there's a corresponding painting that we don't have, but I show a photo of that is called Vincent's Chair. And Vincent's chair is a very ordinary, woven seat. You'd see it in the corner of a kitchen, very common chair. It's like, yeah, it's shoved into the corner of this kitchen. It's got tile floor. And then Gauguin's chair is more ornate, and it's in the middle of a living room, and it's a lot richer, more sumptuous colors. And I encourage guests to tell me, between these two chairs, how do we understand their personalities, or how Vincent saw the two of them, because we're contrasting that.
That's really lovely.
Yeah, it is. And
Something that reminds me of is the idea of keeping. So you were talking about making earlier, and like keeping historical craft alive with the commissioning of making chairs in those techniques. And when you were telling me that story, I was thinking, like, oh, has someone made a Vincent's chair? Is it something that you can sit in? Is it something that you can like pick up and look at and stuff like that? It'd be quite an interesting like student project to be like, what, how can you evoke these people through an item of furniture like that?
A lot of personality in furniture, especially something that's, owned. I mean, Chloe, you're surrounded by furniture from
I
your
was
family.
just thinking that, yeah, we've talked about family furniture and family items that are, entire domestic uses. And this table is, I think maybe only, no, quite a few times actually, but the number of family dinners that I've eaten around this table, and the number of different family members that I've eaten with that are no longer with us, is amazing. It's furniture has such a kind of deep, long life.
And unlike clothing and preserving clothing, I think that furniture is far easier to interact with as time goes by.
Because its use is so is kind of timeless. If you have this domestic items, their use is timeless. It is not that fancy sculptural sideboard that you can't put keys on. It is an antique table that you could wean a baby on and speak in a
Creak.
podcast. Yeah, absolutely.
That's a really nice sort of summary of what furniture means to people through their lives.
Yeah,
And it could grow with you.
I'm now weaning a third generation on this table.
Oh,
Yeah,
wow.
how nice is
That's really
that?
lovely.
Hi everyone. I am joined by a special guest for an interview now. We have Philip Burrows, furniture conservator. Would you like to introduce yourself properly?
Yeah, of course. So, as you say, my name is Philip. I'm a furniture restorer and conservator. I'm based in Guernsey in the Channel Islands. I set up in Guernsey in 2020, which wasn't the best time to do anything really, let alone start a business. Prior to that, I was working in London primarily for two well-established restoration firms. I was there for probably just over 10 years before making the move to Guernsey.
Brill, where did you study?
I didn't, is the short answer.
Oh.
I don't have any formal or otherwise qualifications that would ordinarily, I guess, allow me to do this kind of work. So everything I've learned has been hands-on, kind of on the bench training.
Oh, wow.
For me personally, has been perfect. It's worked really well. I'm not an academic person. I finished school, but I couldn't get through college. I was out halfway through. Very much a sort of hands-on person, so that was perfect for me.
There's lots of people listening to this thinking, oh, I wish I could have done that.
freelance work in this specialism, freelance work in general is very varied, but in this specialism, it must be really varied. Can you describe, just for fun, your perfect project?
Perfect project. The first thing that comes to mind is a project or a treatment that's successful. You know, one that
yeah.
It works out for everyone. Although, you know, some of the more interesting ones are the ones that perhaps don't go to plan, and where you kind of pivot and adapt how you treat something based on something that you found during the course of treatment.
Mine is a massive textile that's in bits, so I have to piece it back together like a giant puzzle and then stitch it in silence for 200 hours. Perfect.
Yeah, that's a complete nightmare for me. I do actually have a specific project, so it's something that I've got booked on the schedule that I'm due to work on in the next few months, and it's a George the First walnut chest on chest, and it really needs practically everything, you know, so consolidation, veneer consolidation, replacement of lost pieces, veneer, feather banding, mouldings, gavetto mouldings, fluted mouldings on the canted corners of the top chest, got shrinkage splits, worn drawer runners. I mean, the list literally goes on and on. On top of all of that, I've got to also treat it for woodworm.
Oh, good.
Which is an interesting one.
Good.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah, that's everything.
Yeah, exactly. And so for that, I'm going to use an anoxic chamber, and it'll be the biggest one that I've personally done. So I'm half looking forward to that and half a little bit worried about it.
Yeah, yes.
Because it's a big object, so it's a big chamber. It's got to be right.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, obviously, good luck. That sounds fantastic. That sounds like, you know, technique tapas and just a bit of all the things.
It's not quite your 200 hours.
You see, that's partly laziness. People say, oh, that's a lot of hard work. But, you know, the thinking you don't have to do when you're doing the same stitching for 200 hours is quite blissful, really.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, this one's probably upwards of 70 hours, I would say.
Oh, okay.
So it's a good,
oh, wow.
Yeah, a good few weeks, give or take.
Mm-hmm. In conservation, we often consider conservation and restoration to be opposed disciplines. Can you describe a combined professional approach?
In some ways, restoring something is a form of conservation.
Mm-hmm.
Restoration gives pieces or objects a chance to kind of continue being used and being relevant and to continue their journey, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and I mean, in my opinion, restoration and conservation are just so closely linked and so overlapping. I've noticed over the past 10 or 15 years, I suppose, that there's a lot of misunderstanding of the two words, or misuse of the two words. You know, museums or institutions especially have kind of worried about being seen to use the word restore, or using restorers or restoration, and they'll always lean more towards conservation, even if the work is, you know, partially or entirely restoration. A huge misunderstanding. I mean, I know of restorers who I've met through BAFRA who were, you know, their business was called Joe Bloggs Restoration, and now it's Joe Bloggs Conservation.
Oh, okay.
And nothing's changed. People work there. They're in the same building, same materials, tools. Nothing's changed except for that word. The way they do things is exactly the same, but it's just kind of, I guess, changing public's perception.
Yeah. And there's people in other parts of the world who, for whom the word is the same, who are wondering what all the fuss is about. So is it the nature of furniture as objects that just lend themselves so easily to approaches that are both conservation and restoration together?
Yeah, I would say so. You know, the furniture is, especially if you're looking at private clients, furniture is nine times out of ten going to be used. You know, it might not be used daily, but there's definitely an element of an object or a piece needing to be functional, whereas perhaps a lot of other decorative arts, that there isn't, you know, a need for an object to be functional. So I've got a real interest in working on instruments, as in musical instruments.
Ah, lovely.
Stringed instruments in particular. And that's what it's similar to furniture. They have to be functional. They have to work. They serve a purpose.
Our Jane Henderson has spoken a lot before about value and the value, what the value of an object is, in exactly these terms of if the use and the function is the value, and you know, without the ability to sit on the chair, is it a chair, and so on.
I think that's what I like about it, is that there's the balance between something needing still surface functionally, still needs to look good, and it still needs to kind of retain its, maybe not original appearance, but it still needs to retain its character. It's a huge grey area. And I think the only line you can draw is, in my opinion, conservation ending when a piece is stable and not at risk of imminent deterioration or even deterioration slightly sort of medium to long term. And then obviously restoration starts after that, when you're making decisions on what to replace, what to reintegrate, and I suppose even functionality comes into that as well.
Yeah.
Because obviously a lot of structural repairs will require a fair amount of intervention, you know, taking on the example of a chair, you know, taking joints apart and
That's really interesting perspective. Yeah. So is there a point at which you'd advise a client to stop or change the use of their item, even considering changes in value with function?
I think for me, a lot of the work I do is for private clients. I do some work for museums and institutions, but primarily at the moment it's private, and usually focus is more on functional pieces, things that be used. I suppose the only barrier is usually cost.
Okay.
That's the only thing that will usually determine whether something will be treated and used, or whether it will be left as is to continue to deteriorate. Fairly recently, I advised a client who their property is south-facing, and he has this huge window with no filtering or anything on it, and fairly nice dining table and chairs. So the long-term plan is to install UV filtering on the glass. Until then, my advice was just to rotate the chairs, minimizing the exposure that they're getting. It does happen, but it's very, very rare.
Something that we were talking about in the bulk of the episode was how to manage the change of use of an item. Is there a way to communicate, or how would you approach the communication of, okay, you can sit on this chair, but maybe for only 5 minutes a day. And, you know, you can use this table, but, you know, don't drink red wine at it. You know, is there a way that you would do that, or would you just accept damage as it comes?
No, I try to be very communicative with clients. I try to give them as much information as possible. There's nothing to hide. This is what I plan to do with it. This is how much it's going to cost. This is the time it's going to take. We can either go for it or not go for it, or you can decide if there's bits that you don't want to go ahead with, that's fine, but these are the consequences. Can we also do that? Yeah, we can, but it means that to get to that, we also need to do this, and this. Yeah, I'm more than happy having an open dialogue with clients on that sort of thing, and that includes use of an object.
Mm-hmm.
In your example with a chair, if my original estimate or my original treatment proposal allowed for a structural repair that would allow the chair to be used completely normally for another 50 years or whatever, and the client said, that's a bit more than I want to spend, are there any other options? I'm happy to provide those other options, but there is always a caveat that, yeah, you can either don't use it at all, it's purely decorative now, or use it, but just be aware that, you know, this joint has, you know, been repaired not exactly in the best way possible. I've even said in the past, this is probably the last time this treatment can be done. Then you're starting to repairs, and it just doesn't work. In my opinion, as long as you're honest and open with the client, that, you know, they're happy.
Thanks for listening. We're the C Word, and today you've listened to Liz, Abby and Chloe. You can find us on thecword.show and contact us on thecwordpodcast@gmail.com. Our intro and outro music is Spring by Dee Dee Mystic. used under Creative Commons Attribution License. This is a Wooden Dice production.